Get to Old Navy for Star Spangled Style. Right now, everything's on sale, up to 60% off. That's right, get everything from tees, shorts, dresses, and swim, all at 60% off. Now till July 7th at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. Valid through 7/7, select styles only.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
You want answers!
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
You ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? What?
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
At the Movies on BFM 89.9.
Hello there, I'm Umar Paganam Pike Pagan, and with the Oscars just a few days away, with La La Land looking like it might just take the big prize, it got me thinking about the Hollywood musical and whether it might make something of a comeback. Is La La Land merely a fleeting moment of nostalgia in an otherwise cynical post-Obama America, or is it a sign of things to come? And what better way to answer that question than to take a trip down memory lane back to the golden age of Hollywood musicals? Tom Santopietro, whom I spoke to last year about the Godfather movies, is the author of what is, in my mind, the definitive book on the sound of music. It's called The Sound of Music Story, and it is the ultimate fan book, with all the inside dope from behind-the-scenes stories of the filming in Austria and Hollywood to new interviews with Johannes von Trapp and many, many others.
Hi, I'm Tom Santopietro, the author of The Sound of Music Story.
So, Tom, there were two reasons why I wanted to speak to you today about The Sound of Music. The first, of course, is given how well La La Land has been doing this award season, I thought we should revisit and talk about one of the greatest musicals of all time. And secondly, given everything that's going on politically in your country, I've always found The Sound of Music to be one of the most subversive attacks on fascism ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But before that, let me tell you my story with Sound of Music. My grandmother used to love this movie, and we used to have it on video cassette. And it used to be running in the background and my home all the time. So I'm like that guy on Oprah who's probably seen this movie 100 times. I've been to that ridiculous Sound of Music tour in Salzburg, and let me tell you, that's the only reason a Malaysian would go to Salzburg. So I'm a huge fan, and I've grown up with the songs, and I remember when I read your book, it was interesting because of all the background drama. And so I had no idea that it was so different. It was less sentimental. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about that, about the real story of the Von Trapp family, if you will.
Well, I think the key issue there is to know that, for fans of the movie worldwide, that although the movie absolutely does not mimic the Von Trapp story step by step, it can't. It's not a documentary, and you have to compress events and change things slightly for dramatic purposes. But the key to realize is that the basic building blocks are accurate. By way of example, the Von Trapps really did escape from the Nazis. It's just that it happened in a slightly different way, which is that instead of the scenic climb over the Alps, they actually dressed as if they were going on a vacation and went by train to Italy. And they did that, and this is where real life becomes, in a way, even more interesting than a movie, because their butler, they were very rich, really, just like in the movie, was a member of the Nazi party, and yet he warned them and said, the borders are going to be closed tomorrow. You need to leave right away. So that's my way of explaining that, of course, it's not the same, and yet the basic principles are the same.
One of the key differences, of course, is Maria's story as well. And in your book, it's quite clear that the roles were somewhat reversed in that she wasn't the softening factor, if you will, on the family, but rather it was the other way around.
Yes, because when people had asked the Von Trapp children after the movie came out, and when I say children, they were, of course, all in their 40s and 50s at the time. They said that their biggest objection was that the movie presented their father as being so stern and autocratic, and in fact, he was a gentle, fun-loving soul who had, in fact, there already was music in the household and that he had taught them. But again, for dramatic purposes, that's what the creators wanted to do. On the other hand, all those things are true. Maria did come from the Abbey. There were seven children, and she became the life force in the family. She really had, in real life, that energy that you see from Julie Andrews on screen.
In telling that story of the Von Trapp family, of this woman who comes in and softens a hard man and makes the children smile again, it feels just infinitely universal that it would appeal across the board. It doesn't matter which culture you come from. It doesn't matter that it was set in Austria. It doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter at all. And it's why the film was a hit literally around the world, on every continent. Well, I don't think it's been shown on Antarctica, but I'm not, I can't speak to that. But, and it's, you are exactly right. It's because it is about family, and that is universal. And it hits on the themes that every one of us wants, desires, which is family as our sanctuary and as our protector, and knowing that we're loved and accepted for who we are. And that is the most basic human emotion. And The Sound of Music tells that story and addresses those issues in a spectacularly crafted fashion.
But am I right in thinking that there was some disconnect between critics and audiences when it first came out?
Well, there was a disconnect. The way, when I really got into the research, the interesting phenomenon, certainly in the United States, which is where it had its first release, is that the critics for the movie industry, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, they love the movie, and the small town papers and medium-sized cities all across the country, they loved it. But the big city critics, particularly New York and Los Angeles, really disliked it, and they went out of their way to criticize it. And of my theory is, of course, that this was the mid-60s, the culture was changing so rapidly, and the counterculture had started. And these critics did not want to be seen as square and sentimental, so they went out of their way to criticize the film out of all proportion to the film, because the passage of time has shown this is a great film. This is a beautifully made film.
In many ways, we're seeing something of that happen today as well with La La Land, in the sense that critics don't like schmaltz, so they can't be seen to be too optimistic or happy or schmaltzy. It just doesn't fly in the face of this cynical new world that we live in.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think, well, my response to that is, you know, it's very sad if they don't allow themselves to feel genuine emotion.
And genuine joy.
And genuine joy, which is what that film delivers. And there is an enormous difference. I say this in the book. They accuse the film of being, the ones who didn't like it, of being too sentimental. But there's a great difference between being sentimental and having great sentiment. And by that, I mean, when you have great sentiment, it's the issues you talked about. It's love of family. It's the sense of inclusion and feeling protected. Those are genuine emotions. Sentimental is when you're completely manipulated. And I think there's a difference between the two. Those critics 50 years ago felt differently than I did, but time has treated the film very well.
So, Tom, how old were you when you saw The Sound of Music, and what was your initial reaction to it?
That's a great question, because everybody who loves the film remembers when they saw it the first time. Yeah, and you're, as an adult, you're looking at the film, but you're also remembering who you were when you first saw it, because as a child, life was less complicated.
And also, you're marking down which one of the children's age you are at as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I remember I grew up in the state of Connecticut, which is about my town was maybe 90 miles from New York City, so pretty close. And we went to, it was a big event. This was a big movie, and we went to a movie theater in another town, and I was 11 years old, and my overwhelming emotion was falling in love with Julie Andrews. I just thought, well, she's the greatest. And of course, the entire world fell in love with Julie Andrews.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you remember seeing it for the first time?
I remember seeing it for the first time on video cassette because I was a child of the 80s, and I only saw it on the big screen decades later at a rescreening in London.
Ah, right.
And that was the only time I'd see it on a big screen. And that was remarkable in itself because I think when you grow up watching something, and you know, it's VHS, it's on one of those crappy CRT televisions, and you forget what it's like, that experience to hear it on all those speakers when she's, you know, running across those green fields. It's something else.
Yeah, it is something else. And that's when you realize, I keep talking about how beautifully made the film is, and that's a perfect example of when you realize it, because you hear the sound and the crispness of the cinematography. All these filmmakers, the director Robert Wise, the cinematographer, they were what's now called the Golden Age of Hollywood. They were Golden Age Hollywood pros at the very end of that era and that system. So they had decades of experience to bring to The Sound of Music, and it all fell together. It just fell into place perfectly. And the basic story was so great. That's why when The Sound of Music was such a huge hit and every studio decided they would make a musical, almost all of them failed because none of them had the great basic material.
And also it was Rodgers and Hammerstein's last musical together.
It was their last musical together, yes. And the very last song that Oscar Hammerstein wrote before he died was Edelweiss. So it's almost like the real-life story reinforces what we're watching on the screen. And, you know, the Von Trapps were a remarkable family. For the book, I interviewed Johannes, who's the youngest of the children. So there were seven children, just like in the movie, different ages and birth order than the movie, but there were seven. Then Maria and the captain had three children together after they married, and Johannes is the youngest. And he is the only one who was born in the United States, and I interviewed him. And it was fascinating listening to the reaction of their family to the movie. And the big point I like to always say to people when I give talks on the movie, and this is regards the your question about was it accurate, you know, did they change things, is I always say, this is why the Von Trapps are worthy of our respect, because in the movie, the captain refuses to serve in the Navy of the Nazis and they have to escape. And that really happened. He did refuse. And yet there were two other times the family defied Hitler. They were invited, and I use that word, obviously it wasn't an invitation, it was a demand, to sing on the radio in honor of Hitler's birthday. And they absolutely refused to do it. And the oldest son, oldest child was a son, not a daughter, as in the movie. And he, by the time of when the Nazis came into power, he was a doctor. And he was, again, invited, which is demanded, to take a position at a hospital in Vienna. And he said, absolutely not. The only reason that position is available is because you don't allow Jewish doctors to practice. So they defied Hitler three times.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
And also an almost impossible decision to make at the time.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, it's one thing for us to be saying this 50 years later. But at the time, this would have gotten them thrown in jail. This would have, you know, destroyed their lives. So I always say to the people who criticize it as not realistic, I say, in real life, they defied Hitler three times. This is so worthy of our admiration, I believe.
The making of The Sound of Music, though, is hidden behind that veneer of happiness and joy and color. But it was tough. There's a great story in your book about the multiple takes that Julie Andrews needed for that remarkable scene of her running through the fields, a downdraft of the helicopter beating down, the freezing cold.
All of that, you've summarized it well, and you know, it's on screen, it's flawless, and it just
it's perfect.
But in real life, the downdraft from the helicopter was so strong that it kept knocking Julie Andrews over into the mud, and they were having to do take after take of that. The farmer who owned the land where they shot that sequence got mad, and because he said that the filmmakers were disrupting the milk production from his cows. And so he got so mad that the brook that's there, he took a pitchfork and drained the brook. So, because the filmmakers had actually built the brook to make it look scenic. And he drained it, and he's swearing in German at Julie Andrews, who was very funny afterwards, said, "Fortunately, I didn't understand a word of German." So there are all these difficulties that come in to the making, and yet ultimately it just unfolds on screen perfectly, you know, with a seamless quality that all the best movies can achieve.
Even Christopher Plummer, who thought himself too much of a thespian for your run-of-the-mill musical.
Oh, absolutely. He was very dismissive of the material. He felt it was beneath him because, you know, he had just finished playing Hamlet. He was an acclaimed stage actor, but unknown for films. And he felt this was beneath him. And it's very funny because the actors who played the seven children in the film said that as a result, what you see on screen is genuine. They all absolutely adored Julie Andrews. I mean, these kids were in love with her, and they were all scared of Christopher Plummer because he was so sort of forbidding off camera. And yet that helps inform the film because that serves the story as well, you know, to love Maria and to be afraid of the captain. And that's what was happening in real life as well.
And I'm assuming that he warmed up throughout the production as well in real life, and that came across too.
Well, yes, I think what has happened is that over the years, he has come to terms with the enormous legacy of this film, and he realizes what an important part the film has played in the lives of millions of people around the world. So he's much more accepting of it. He can still be a little grumpy about it, but it sort of depends almost on what day you talk to him. You know, there's a quote from him where he has said, "I'm proud to have been a part of this film." So that's, I think he really does accept it now.
It's tough though, Tom, isn't it? I mean, every time I think about great works of cinema and great works of music, I can only imagine how frustrated Eric Clapton must be every time someone asks him to play Layla just one more time.
I think that's a great analogy. This happens to anybody in any art form where one particular expression hits the heartstrings of people. And I think it's very tough to escape that shadow. For Julie Andrews, you know, it was really tough because everybody expected her to be as perfect in real life as Maria is on screen. And Julie Andrews is an incredibly nice professional woman, but she's not perfect. You know, nobody is. And so it's that sense of always having to live up to people's expectations. And I think that happened to the real Von Trapps as well in their reaction to the film because they appreciate the film and what it has done for their family. But on the other hand, just think about trying to escape the shadow of your own family is on the movie screen and everybody's perfect. Nobody misbehaves. Well, that's not real life. And I think that was a little difficult for them in real life to constantly be competing with an idealized image.
So, Tom, I was watching La La Land, and I think I've seen that movie three times. I'm a big fan of musicals, and it was nice to see a modern day take of a good old-fashioned Hollywood musical. I mean, it wasn't nearly as good as any of those movies, but I think it was a great little homage. And the one thing that kept going through my mind and I think it's somewhat reinforced throughout this award season, is that it seems like La La Land, while it may not necessarily be the best film on that list of nominees, it seems like the film that America is relating to most right now. Given everything else that's going on in the country, it seems that that's the kind of escapism that people are looking for.
I think everything you just said is 100% accurate. I think that's it exactly. There is, in the United States right now, after this election of November with Trump winning, we're such a divided country now, and there is such a sense of unease about Donald Trump and this volatile character we have in the White House. So the feel of La La Land is exactly what people want. It's an escape. It's a romance. People are singing and dancing. And it is a very, you know, it's a very good, it's an enjoyable film. But I think it has taken off the way it has because it's what people need at the present time. And have you ever seen the film That's Entertainment?
Yes, I have.
You know, the compilation of all the great musicals. And when it was first released, which was in the 1970s, it always stuck in my mind. The tagline for the advertising was, "That's entertainment. Boy, do we need it now!" Exclamation point. And that, of course, is La La Land in the United States of 2017.
Because that other reading of The Sound of Music, that subtext behind this great musical, is that it was this deep, abiding message of a family coming together, saying no to Adolf Hitler, fighting fascism through sheer will and music and love.
Absolutely. It's about fighting that authoritarian, you know, figure, in that case, fascism. And it's about love of homeland. And that also strikes a chord with people around the world. I think I'm assuming and hoping that your listeners love their homeland. And, you know, this is a universal emotion. And in The Sound of Music, it's just told so beautifully. I always try to say to people, I think on the biggest reason why it resonates, you know, there's the love of family in it, but what The Sound of Music does, it gives us all hope. And, you know, life can be very, very uncertain for people. You never know what's around the corner. This is true for any of us. And I call them the moments when the ground shifts beneath your feet. And you think, how did that happen? You know, what happened to my job? You know, all these things that happen to us. And The Sound of Music is there giving us hope, saying you can survive, you can get through that. And it makes you feel connected to other people. E.M. Forster, the great novelist who wrote Passage to India, his famous statement was, "Only connect. Only connect." And that's what The Sound of Music does. It makes you feel connected. It makes you feel like you're not alone. And that is a great gift for all of us.
It won the Best Picture Award in 1966. It's still one of the highest grossing American movies of all time. The last time we saw a musical take home the Oscar for Best Movie, or at least the closest thing to a musical, is probably The Artist. And even The Artist's message at the end of it was, hey, progress is coming, right? We're going to have color and sound in the pictures, so it's time to forget the past and move on. Meanwhile, something like La La Land is actually a hark back to that past. It's rooted entirely in nostalgia. It's set on the Hollywood lot, for God's sakes. I mean, it doesn't get any more nostalgic than that. And my question to you is, do you think the musical will make something of a comeback in Hollywood, or is that time gone?
The time is forever gone when musicals were churned out in such abundance and with craftsmen and artists as skilled as Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly and Judy Garland. See, at the time, it was mainstream music. Now it's pushed to the side because we live in the era of rock music. But what the great thing about La La Land is doing is that because it's such a big success, I think there are going to be more musicals now. They're, I think, finally getting around to making a musical of the Broadway hit Wicked. And so there are going to be other musicals. It'll just never be the abundance we had in the 1940s and 1950s.
And they may not necessarily be the big box office successes that My Fair Lady and Sound of Music were.
Right. I mean, I think that's the other thing is to, the mentality in Hollywood now is it has to be a blockbuster, you know, and so they don't, it's like even if it's a moderate success, it's almost as if they think, well, that's not good enough. And that's the tricky thing. That's why they don't make movies for adults so much, and they make, you know, all the big movies are all those comic book movies, you know, about cartoon characters. I think it's tricky, but I just read a big article recently, and they said that Hollywood studios are more interested in musicals now simply because of La La Land. So I think, oh, that's great. You know, they're making a new movie of Mary Poppins. I'm not sure we need a new movie because I thought
the first one was really great. It was really great. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know if we need a new take on it, but at least they're willing to deal with musicals again. And I think, you know, in Hollywood, it's what the most recent success, that's what everybody wants to then imitate. And right now it's La La Land.
But also we don't have the A-listers who can sing and dance the way Gene Kelly or Rex Harrison or Julie Andrews could.
No, we don't have stars of that magnitude any longer. The last one who came along in those terms, really, was Barbara Streisand, you know, with Funny Girl. And she's really the last of the line. That's sad because, you know, musicals give people such great joy. It's why we're talking about the Sound of Music 50-plus years later. But the tradition changes, and we just have to hope, you know. When I watched La La Land, I was watching Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, and I thought to myself, well, they are certainly not a threat to Fred Astaire and Judy Garland, but you know what? They give great entertainment. This is, you know, making a lot of people feel good. I'm all for it.
And of course, Singing in the Rain and Sound of Music and My Fair Lady, they're not going anywhere. They're there. They're great movies that will forever be there to be appreciated by audiences. So it's not like we're losing anything.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's the magic of film, is that it lives forever. And, you know, that's the big difference with live theater, because it's so magical when you're there in the room with those performers. You feel so connected in the theater when it's live and in front of you. And then when the show is over, it has disappeared forever. It only lives on in your memory. But with film, it's there in front of you forever. So that's a kind of fun difference in why we can all love both the live theater and the film for different reasons.
But I have to say, though, there are some things about musicals and the way Hollywood used to make them that Damien Chazelle captured a little bit of in La La Land, the momentum of the camera and how it was constantly moving. It's something that you don't necessarily see in many big budget movies these days.
No, and that's because The Sound of Music was kind of the culmination of 30 years of developing expertise with musicals. And the filmmakers use a different vocabulary today. And that's why it comes across so well on screen, because every detail was so thought out in advance. And when I was researching the book, Robert Wise, the director, he didn't leave even the smallest question or detail untouched. And that's what makes the film so great, because that's the essence of art. That's what Stephen Sondheim wrote about in Sunday in the Park. You know, every little detail plays a part, and that's what Robert Wise was able to do. He was a truly great, underrated filmmaker.
Tom, do you have a favorite moment from the movie? Mine is the puppet show, without a doubt. And I think it's got a lot to do with the fact that that is the most poignant memory I have watching the movie as a kid.
Ah, well, I really have three favorite moments. There's the puppet show, because it just makes you feel so good. The tune is so infectious.
Absolutely.
you know, that, and that's, we get great joy from that. The second one is, of course, the whole title sequence when she's alone singing The Sound of Music, because it's so beautiful. And the third, which maybe in a way is my favorite, is the whole montage of Do Re Mi, because
yes,
it's a great song with such energy, and it's also, it's a Valentine to the city of Salzburg. It makes Salzburg look so beautiful, and it makes you understand even more why the Von Trapps loved their homeland so much. So you go with the puppet show as your favorite moment. I'll go with Do Re Mi.
Fantastic. And Tom, I think it's important we tell people that Edelweiss is not the national anthem of any country.
The, and that was a, you know, I have this in the book, a major faux pas that during the Reagan administration, the director of protocol, the president of Austria, was the I'm not sure if it's president or chancellor, but was visiting the Reagan White House, and the director of protocol instructed the band to play Edelweiss because she thought it was the Austrian national anthem. So, but it's not. And the last, just one story that I have in the book that people might really enjoy is that during the Reagan White House, there was a big economic summit, and they had prepared a briefing book for President Reagan and for the next day's meetings, and they gave it to him. And when they went in the next morning, Jim Baker, the chief of staff, realized that President Reagan had not even looked at the book, and he was very upset and kind of horrified that the president hadn't looked at it. And he said, "Mr. President, you didn't even read this." And President Reagan said, "Jim, how could I have read that book? The Sound of Music was on television last night."
That is wonderful.
And that says everything about whatever your political inclinations are. That says everything about the appeal of the film.
Tom, it is always a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this. And, you know, the book is out there for everybody, and it's in print. It's on ebook form. I think if you like the film, you'll really enjoy the book, because I love the film too, and that's why I wrote the book.
That was Tom Santopietro. He is the author of 5 incredible books on the history of cinema, including The Sound of Music Story, The Godfather Effect, Sinatra in Hollywood, Considering Doris Day, and The Importance of Being Barbara. You can find all of his books on Amazon.com. I've included a link to them on our podcast page. They really are well worth reading. Do let me know if you think La La Land deserves to win the Best Picture at this year's Oscars. Do let me know if you'd like to see more musicals on cinema. Tweet me. I'm on @UmarPagan or on BFM Radio. You've been listening to At The Movies. This is BFM 89.9.
Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it.
All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold cut combo, veggie delight, or black forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.